Turn with me, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 12 through 15 again. For the sake of time, this is already on tape, and it's a matter of fact, this message will be going out sometime shortly on the tape ministry, so I don't need to read it for this message. We've already read that today, so you know what's stated in there. Basically, almost a reiteration with a few changes from what we read in Exodus chapter 20 regarding the Sabbath commandment, the commandment itself, not necessarily the statutes or not the statutes or the judgment for the commandment, but the commandment itself is found in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verses 12 through 15. R.J. Rushdooney in the Institutes of Biblical Law stated that, this, quote, the Sabbath is not an infringement of man's liberty, but rather the liberation of man, end of quote. Better yet, Yeshua the Messiah declared, quote, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. This will be the fourth commandment, part 4. In the previous message, I began an exposition on the how of the weekly Sabbath. The majority, as I mentioned in the last message, the majority of Sabbath discussion is directed at the when of the Sabbath and normally just the when of the weekly Sabbath. Well, this series, as I mentioned on the fourth commandment, is devoted to the how, first devoted to the how, and then to the what of the Sabbath, and that will be explained as we get into the different statutes. In part 3, I shared with you the following partial list of what God expects from us in our Sabbath observance. First, abstention from work, business, and occupation. Second, constraint from buying and selling. Thirdly, refrainment from our own pleasure. And fourthly, attention to the worship and service of our God. There are also a couple other specific areas that I didn't deal with in the last message that do deserve our attention because they are specifically dealt with in the Scriptures, i.e. cooking and traveling. Not necessarily, at least the first one, not necessarily my expertise, but nonetheless needs to be dealt with because the Bible does deal with it. Both, at least, appear to be addressed in the same passage of Scripture, dealing with Yahweh's provision of the manna in the wilderness to the Israelites in Exodus 16, if you want to turn to it. Exodus 16, and beginning with verses 4 and 5. And again, just for the sake of time, I'll just read these as I get to them. Exodus 16, verse 4. Then said Yahweh unto Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, and that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. And it shall come to pass that on the sixth day they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. And then jump down to verse 21. Verse 21, And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating. When the sun waxed hot, it melted. And it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for one man, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, This is that which Yahweh hath said. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto Yahweh. Bake that which you will bake today, and seize that which you will seize. And that which remaineth over lay up for you to be kept until the morning. And they laid it up till morning, as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worm therein. And Moses said, Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath unto Yahweh. Today you shall not find it in the field. 6 days ye shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. And Yahweh said unto Moses, How long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for Yahweh hath given you the Sabbath. Therefore he giveth you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide ye every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. From verse 23, it's established that preparation and cooking for 2 days was to be done on the day preceding the Sabbath, so that none would be done on the Sabbath. You can read it again if you didn't pick it up the first time through it. Now, let me make some suggestions for this particular area that you might find handy, at least from my own experience. One way to apply this particular situation for the Sabbath, God made provisions that they certainly could eat on the Sabbath, but one way to take care of this, so there doesn't have to be this extra work involved in the day before, it's simply to fast on the Sabbath. Somebody was, I think Josephine was pointing out in our table talk this morning, or this afternoon, that That's very good to fast one day of the week. I'm sure if Doug was here, he would verify the fact that it's good for us. It's a healthy way to live. It's to fast one day a week. Well, I think probably if you're going to do it on the Sabbath. And then you automatically don't have to worry about preparations and cooking for the Sabbath. Now, there are some health situations and other situations wherein that is not advisable. Some people simply cannot fast for health reasons. And so it doesn't always work for everyone. So as an alternative, instead of preparing 2 days' worth of meals, go raw one day. I'm not talking about in the flesh. Eat raw fruits and vegetables. That's what we do as a family. On the Sabbath, between the hours that we believe the Sabbath is what the Bible teaches for the Sabbath, we simply, for the most part, eat raw vegetables and raw fruit, and cheeses and crackers and that kind of thing, which is, again, extremely healthy. Matter of fact, most of us should be eating more that way every day of our life. God intends us to eat more raw food. And it's a very hard transition. At least I know I find it for me to go from prepared foods to raw foods. But it's I think once you get started, it's a much easier transition. Why not take care of the problem? And that, of course, eliminates cooking on the Sabbath and extra work the day before, which in this day in society, and especially with the way things are, especially if you're like my wife, with homeschooling and the other things that go on and not a lot of help from her husband. Not that I don't give her some, and I do, but 2 days' preparations isn't going to help her any. I think she would hardly have any rest of Sabbath just worrying about the next one coming up. So go raw. That's at least one way to do it. I believe the same principle that's found in that previous passage is being dealt with, also dealt with in Exodus 35, 1 through 3, regarding the kindling of the fire. You might remember that passage. Exodus 35, beginning with verse 1. Verse 1, "And Moses gathered all the congregation of the children of Israel together and said unto them, These are the words which Yahweh hath commanded that you should do them. 6 days shall work be done, but on the seventh day there shall be to you an holy day, a Sabbath of rest to Yahweh. Whosoever doeth work, therein shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire throughout your habitations upon the Sabbath day." Well, does that mean that God intends His people to freeze during the winter? No, I don't think so. Most commentators you'll find believe that has to do with only the starting of a fire. And again, I think it's just simply pointing out the same principle, and that is to take care of things or make preparations the day before. Get the fire started. Or they were told to basically get the fire started. They could keep it going throughout the Sabbath, but they were to get it going. Get your preparations done. Again, the principle of the matter, a little preparations and forethought will take care of most of these things before the Sabbath ever begins. The specifics of this passage, I don't believe, even applies to this day and age, simply because, at least in America, there are few homes which that depend on fires as their primary means of heat and cooking. And with electricity and gas, the preparations for receiving it have basically already been accomplished long before it's ever received into the household. So there's really not a lot of application other than the principle. And again, reinforces and brings home the fact that whatever can be done before the Sabbath, to prepare for the Sabbath, should be done before the Sabbath ever begins. The same is also, I believe, true with the intent of Numbers chapter 15 and verses 32 through 36. Verse 32, "And while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man that gathered sticks upon the Sabbath day." What were the sticks for? Well, for the cooking fire or the heat. And there is this possibility that this man was intending to gather them to make for increase to sell them to those who wouldn't. And of course, they'd have been just as guilty had they bought them from him, but that's at least a possibility. Verse 33, "And they found him gathering sticks, and they that found him gathering sticks brought him unto Moses and Aaron and unto all the congregation, and they put him in a ward," or custody, NASV, "because it was not declared what should be done to him. And Yahweh said unto Moses, The man shall be surely put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp." Verse 36, "And all the congregation brought him without the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died as Yahweh commanded Moses." This too, again, I believe, is intended to teach us to pre-prepare before the Sabbath begins. Or again, possibly this man was gathering sticks to sell them and he was being condemned for that reason as well. Whichever it was, it can be seen that this Sabbath transgression was a serious matter with God. You know, and I'll admit, it is hard for me to really comprehend why this Sabbath would be, why this particular transgression would be considered a capital crime. I have a hard time with that. But that really doesn't matter, does it? Whether I have a hard time with it or whether you have a hard time with it. If God says it's a capital crime, in His mind it's a capital crime. And keep this in mind too. I think I pointed this out in the second message, that is there any other capital crime that was abrogated come New Testament or New Covenant times? Is murder still a capital crime in God's sight? Is rape still, in a certain situation, still a capital crime? Is homosexuality still a capital crime under the New Covenant? Of course it is. And so if that, I mean, something as serious a capital crime, I mean that, and again, something which speaks of the morality of our God, it's a serious matter. And I think far too many of us, including myself, have not taken this Sabbath seriously enough. It is a serious matter before God. Also in the Exodus 16 passage that we looked at a little bit ago, in verse 29 we find again the following instruction. It says, "Remain or abide every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." Now, let me ask you, do you think that was meant to be taken literally? That you were to stay right there inside your home and not go out for that 24-hour period? Or was it referring to that current situation that was being dealt with in Exodus 16? Well, in light of Ezekiel 46, 1 through 3, where we found in the last message that the prince and the people were all to go to the temple to worship God, obviously, on the Sabbath, obviously that reference there that I just gave to you from verse 26 to 29, whatever it was not meant to be taken literally, that they were to stay put right in the house. Now, some people have taken it to that extreme, and I believe have become legalistic and have not taken it within the context or in consideration of its context or in consideration of such passages as Ezekiel 46. I don't believe it can be taken literally. However, instead, I'm convinced that it was specifically dealing with that situation at hand. That is, that they were to remain home rather than going out and gathering provisions and victuals. Not that they were to remain home, period, but that they were to remain home rather than going out and doing what was being done in that situation. In modern terms, do what shopping needs to be done for the Sabbath day before the Sabbath begins. Or put another way, take care of such outings prior to the Sabbath. And thus, in that sense, remain at home rather than doing those things. Now, with that, it should be pointed out that Scripture does refer to a Sabbath day's journey. Turn to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 1. Or I'm there already, just listen to it. Acts chapter 1 and verse 12. It says this, "Then they returned in Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is from Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey. Now the Pharisees determined this to be about 2,000 cubits, or approximately two-thirds of a mile in today's jargon, which was fairly well established, was a distance from the outside perimeter of the camp of Israel while they were in the wilderness, to the tabernacle and back to the outside." So that the ones who were on the outside perimeter of the camp would go that distance, obviously, at least travel that far and back in order to have holy convocation at the tabernacle on the Sabbath day. And so that was what was pretty much decided by the Pharisees or their predecessors as being a Sabbath day's journey. Now, it should be noted that nowhere in the law are such specifications given. However, I do believe that's a fair representation of what the Israelites probably practiced in that day, because the day was devoted to the service of Yahweh. Now, there would have been maybe some extenuating circumstances where they had to bury a man and go outside the camp, and thus the distance became further, and there was an exemption for further distance. But generally, as a rule, that probably was the practice of that day, what it took to go from the outside perimeter and back to the tabernacle and back. However, I am personally convinced that that is no longer applicable. If that is indeed what God had in mind, it is no longer applicable for us today, in the sense that times have changed once again, and our mode of our means of travel has also changed. We no longer again walk as our means of travel or again ride beasts of burden. Thus, there is virtually no work involved in traveling, whether it be for beast or animal today. I don't think that God intended us to rest our automobiles, but that was also a requirement of at least I haven't been, maybe somebody can prove to me it's good for diesel and gasoline engines too, but I have yet to see that proven, so I don't think it necessarily applies to resting your automobile or your truck. But I don't believe our places of worship in this day and age have, as a general rule, are much further away. There's very few of us, if any of us here probably here, who live next to the place where we're going to have holy convocation. And so that has to be taken into account as well. As a result, our Sabbath day's journey has been lengthened for 20th century man from what it was for our predecessors during Moses' time. Here's my own thumb of rule. For church services and ministerial work, the distance, I believe, is extended to whatever is necessary. Again, keeping in mind, I just came from Nebraska to to Wisconsin. But seriously, because understanding that there is already, we've already established that there is an exemption for the counterparts today for the Levites and the priests and their work and what needed to be accomplished. And so I think there is that extension for those purposes. Otherwise, if we're on the road, which is not normally the case, but if there's a case where we do need to be on the road that we can't avoid, then we limit our distance to whatever becomes tiresome and stop there, which is going to be obviously a lot longer distance. I'll guarantee I can go a lot further in an automobile than I can go on horseback without getting tired. And my horse isn't going to get tired that way either. So I think we have to take some of these things. And again, I am not trying to make excuses or trying to get around God's law. I'm trying to make sense of the application that we have to understand. Too often we take the principles of the Scriptures and make them laws in and of themselves. And I think we do disservice to God and to His people, and we just end up causing confusion. And the people in the outside world sometimes look at us with a squint in their eye, wondering who and what planet we came from. We're not doing our service. Now, I am not for compromising God's word in the least. I mean, if there is something that's cut and dry, that's a law, a statute, a judgment, then we need to hold true to it because it's the truth of God's word and take whatever comes our way. And some of these things we need to think about and see if there isn't some of God's application. And I may be wrong. Matter of fact, I'll guarantee you, I've shared this enough, probably most of you have heard it enough, but I'll guarantee you right now, I'll tell you, I will admit to you, I'm a false prophet. I am. Well, go find another one. Because we all are. Just some are intentional false prophets and some aren't. I don't know of anything that I'm intentionally. There is nothing I'm intentionally teaching falsely. God guarantee I'm teaching some things falsely. And if I'm wrong on this, God's grace is going to cover it because He knows my heart. It fits again in with Romans 14. That He knows that what I'm doing unto the Lord, and hopefully He knows that same for you. And if you don't agree with on some of my applications of these principles, then do it your way, but don't divide over it. Your Lord is my Lord. My Lord is your Lord, hopefully. Now, some people might view such regulations as infringement upon our liberties rather than liberation as itself, as Russ Dooney put it. But it all depends on your perspective of these regulations. Kind of reminds me of the tightwad farmer who was approached by a stranger who came by and said, "Well, how much is your prized Jersey heifer worth?" The farmer, for a moment, scratched his chin and he said, "Well, let me ask you a question. Are you a tax assessor or was she just hit by a truck?" See, it all matters. It's all a matter of perspective. Perspective means everything. You think about that. Perspective so often means everything. It all depends, these regulations, it all depends on your perspective. And of greater importance, it depends on your perspective of God Himself. If your view of Yahweh is one of a tyrant who desires to enslave His people, then indeed these regulations, these Sabbath regulations, along with the rest of his law, become oppressive rather than liberating. But keep in mind, only in your mind. Because it's your view of Yahweh that makes it so, not Yahweh himself. On the other hand, if your perspective of Yahweh is one of a loving father looking out for his children who only requires of them what's best for them, then indeed these regulations are liberating. And too often the Sabbath is looked on that wrong perspective. Like, why in the world would God want to limit me that way? What gives him the right to do so? Well, a child could look, my children could look, I'm very sometimes regulating with my children. It's only because I'm doing what I believe to be best for them. And they could say the same thing. But the answer is, and how they respond to it again, is based on their perspective. How they see me as their father. Obviously, the example applies to God as well. Depending on what perspective it is. The regulations can either drive us from God, or they can be that which draws us even closer to Him. Because of knowing and understanding His love. Remember, under the New Covenant, we keep His law, including the Sabbath of regulations, not because we're forced to. Hopefully, that's not why you're keeping any of these things. Not because you're forced to, but rather because we desire to, because of His love for us and our love for Him and our fellow man. And that'll make all the difference in the world. Now, in the last message, I also pointed out some of the exceptions to these general rules or regulations for the Sabbath. Exceptions such as ministerial duties for doctors and nurses, hospitals, ambulance services, other emergency services, firemen, emergency telephone services, some food services and energy services providing heat and electricity. Deeds of kindness are also exempt, as we saw, even when strenuous work is involved. Also warfare, soldiers under siege, or even on some offensive maneuvers, were not required to Sabbath. Not in some cases that the situation may not have allowed them to do so and that they would do so. But if in doing so, it would give the enemy an advantage, they were not required to. Those are at least some of the areas. And I know some of you probably have some other areas in mind that would probably be exemption as well. But those are at least some of the areas of exemption to the normal Sabbath regulations. Now, in the last message, I left you with the question, what about farming? Is there an exemption for farmers? Well, a farmer was finishing haying one Sunday as the preacher drove by, and he stopped and he said, don't you know that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh? And the farmer said, yeah, I knew that as he was watching the threatening storm clouds come in. He said, but God finished his work and I haven't. Well, is that the right outlook? Well, when it comes to the care of their animals, we already know that it is. Look at another passage, Luke chapter 13. Luke 13 and verse 15. It says, the Lord then answered him and said, thou hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his ass from the stall and lead him away to watering? And of course, he then used that to say, isn't it all right? Isn't it in the same way also then, even more so, correct or right to loose someone who's bound with a sickness or a disease or whatever? But the point was is that everybody understood it would be okay to lead the animal to water, so that we have a case where that is the situation. At the same time, except for emergencies, most animal needs can be taken care of, prepared for, prior to the inception of the Sabbath and remain in fine condition until the Sabbath ends. And so most of those chores, with the exception of possibly milking, become cruel and destructive even to allow an animal to go that long without being milked. But there are some exceptions to the rule too. But in most situations, even the farmer can take care of that work before the Sabbath begins. So a little forethought will take care of that. What about during planting and harvesting times? Are those times that the farmer, because of the urgency of the moment, is exempt from the usual prohibition against work? How many of you would say that he's exempt? How many of you would say he's not exempt? how many are gun-shy and won't declare yourself? Well, for those of you who said he's not exempt, you can give yourself a pat on the back of on your back. Turn to Exodus 34. And those will be there'll be three more gun-shy in the next message. Exodus 34 and verse 21. Verse 21, 6 days thou shalt work, but on the seventh day thou shalt rest, even in earing, which simply means plowing time and harvest, thou shalt rest. Isn't it interesting? He knew farmers would say, you know, hey, we've got to put the seed in, you know, the moon is right, it's got to be now or never. He said, no, even in harvest and planting, you keep Sabbath. In other words, he's saying, I want, even in those pressing times of need, in those situations, I want you to trust me. He's saying, listen, in this situation, one day is not going to make a difference. And he's saying, I want you to trust me that I'll provide. I'm the God who provided manna two times as much on the sixth day for the seventh day. Don't forget. I provided for it. And keep in mind, every other day it spoiled. There was never any left over. The God who did that says, I want you to trust me even in those pressing times. And after all, isn't he the one that provides the rain and the sunshine that makes it all work together? You know, I wonder if sometimes he doesn't hold back from our farmers some of those things because they disobey him in what they can have a part in. I wonder how many farmers would have far less problems in their farming operations today if they just obey this one law on the Sabbath. The weekly Sabbath day of rest. Now, there's another area of exemption that is very seldom, if ever, addressed. Matter of fact, I have never heard anyone address this area of exemption on the Sabbath. And it's the exception made for those in captivity. Do you think that the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, or others, provided the Israelites a Sabbath while enslaved in their captivity? We already know that they didn't. So do you think Yahweh held those Israelites accountable for Sabbath desecration in the same way when it was out of their control, in the same way he did when it was in their control? In many cases, that was one of the reasons they were in captivity. And nonetheless, there's no indication that he held them accountable for Sabbath desecration when it was out of their control to have it that way. So let me ask you this. Does our current government, does our current economic system, do most of our employers provide for Sabbaths under this current situation that we live under today? Well, some do and some don't, depending on your occupation. Your employer may force you to work on the Sabbath, or he may not. In some cases, in this mystery Babylonian captivity, if you want to call it that, it's either, for some people, it's either work on the Sabbath or get fired. So, in such cases, what should Christians do? Well, I'm hearing different answers out there. I'm going to tell you, there's no pat answer for that question. Now, if it was me, I can tell you what I would do. I would do everything in my power if I was in such a situation to find other employment so as not to have to work on what I believe to be the Sabbath. That's what I would do, but I'm not going to hold everybody. Though I think that's probably what people should do. But sometimes you can exhaust all the options and there's just nothing else available. You know, I think about women who have been deserted by their husbands and so forth. And so under such conditions, that is under a non-Christian civil body politic, which is what we currently have here in this country for the most part, under a societal system that is not necessarily set up with Sabbath observance in mind, as well as most of the other laws of Yahweh, I believe that there is an exemption provided for those who have no choice. And that exemption, I believe, is found in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. Again, I'm there. You can just listen to it as I read it to you. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, it says, therefore let us... No, I'm not there. Keep looking. That was Corinthians. 1 Timothy chapter 5. Okay, 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. It says, "But if any provide not for his own, and specially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." Let me read it again. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8, it says, "But if any provide not for his own, and specially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." In other words, there's a greater law, much like emergency medical treatment, I believe, that comes into play. And when one has the choice to either keep Sabbath or starve himself and his family, I believe the latter takes precedence, that he had better take care of his family. That's under the conditions that we currently live in, which I see as a semi-captivity. They'd like to make it total captivity. And so it doesn't apply to everyone. Some people may just use that as an excuse, and that doesn't count. But when it's a situation when the person, at least in their mind and their understanding, has exhausted all their options, then I believe that is an exemption. Now, somebody may say, and this may be the case, that, well, it's just a matter of faith. You know, step out and God will provide. Well, that could be. But, you know, there was a man who once prayed, "Lord, help me in my unbelief." You know, sometimes all of us are at different levels of even faith. What we can do, or what we believe that can be done, or what God even expects of us. And again, all of this so much applies to our outlook at each one, how we deal with one another on some of these issues. You know, it's about time we start expecting from ourselves what we expect from others, how to be treated. Those kind of areas are terms often termed by a lot of people as works of necessity. And I do believe, according to 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8, that they are exempted. Now, in such cases, those Christians should treat the Sabbath the same as those who work in a exempted area. That is, if they are forced to work on the Sabbath, then take Sabbath on another day. And again, there's biblical precedence for doing that. Now, understanding, once again, this last area of exemption, that is because of captivity. I believe understanding that should eliminate a lot of judging and condemning of one another, of our brethren who may be forced, because of Christian Israel's current captivity, to keep the Sabbath differently than you or I may. It should eliminate that. We are not living under an ideal system, people, and we have to do the best. This law was meant to be kept nationally, and we're trying to the best of our ability to keep it individually. Segregation is another one I could use as an example. We cannot fulfill God's laws of segregation as God's intended us to, because it's a national law. We can only do it to a limited basis individually. And I may be able to individually do it better than you are because of my personal situations or circumstances. But I better be tolerant of you, and you better be tolerant of me if it's the other way around. At least if you understand or believe or have no reason to doubt that what I'm doing to the best of my ability for my Lord. You're required not to judge or ostracize me when that's the case. We must take into consideration the religious/government climate, which are essentially one and the same. There's no difference between religion and government, no matter what the separation of church and state people want to tell you, in and out of Judeo-Christianity. There's no difference. It's one and the same thing. But that religious/government climate must be taken into consideration, the one that we currently live under right now. If Christian Israel, applying Yahweh's laws, not only on an individual basis, but on a societal level, was in control of the body politic, it would be unequivocally a different situation than we currently have right now. Many questions and situations that we deal with on an individual basis would simply vanish because they wouldn't exist. Because Yahweh's laws being the laws of the land, would eliminate most of those situations. For example, no employer of a non-exempt business or industry would be permitted to force somebody to work on the Sabbath. Those would be national laws in accordance with God's laws, if God's laws indeed were the laws of the land. As a matter of fact, such enterprises wouldn't even be open on the Sabbath. enterprises like Walmart, or restaurants for the most case, or ballparks. Oh, that's going to step on some toes. But those things would just be taken care of. There'd be another day for those things. And many, many other areas of life would be different as well, just if we applied the fourth commandment, let alone all the other commandments. And so that has to be taken into consideration. There has to be an understanding of what the situation we're currently under in comparison to what it would be if indeed we lived under the ideal conditions of God's laws being applied in this land. Now, with all of that, we do need to be careful that we don't use this area of exemption or any of the others as a loophole or an excuse to get around what God's law actually does say, rather than what Yahweh would have us to do. There's no question that when we live under a system governed by love and freedom, as we do and at least should under the Christian covenant, rather than a system of fear and strict compliance, as was the rule of the day under the Mosaic covenant, it does come with some land traps, if you will, or pitfalls. It's one of the things that the Apostle Paul addressed in Galatians chapter 5. If you've got your Bible, I want you to turn to this one because I think this is extremely important. I want you to read it with me. Galatians chapter 5, and I'll begin with verse 1. On one hand, in verse 1, he declares, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ has made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage." What was that yoke of bondage? Well, if you were to ask the majority of Christian, Judeo-Christian preachers across this land today, they would say the yoke of the bondage was the law. But again, if they said that, I would come back with what law? And it's very, very, it's clarified actually a little bit later on this passage, which I won't get into. But it's very clear that it was the Mosaic love covenant, which was the law which was added 430 years later after the promises. The covenant that demanded strict compliance to his laws for justification and righteousness. And he's saying, don't allow yourself to get back into that kind of bondage, on one hand. On the other hand, knowing the pitfalls which come with freedom, he declares in verse 13 the following, "For brethren, you have been called unto liberty. Only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another." Let me read it to you. It's a little bit clearer in the New American Standard Version. "For you were called to freedom, brethren, only did not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." It's an easy trap to fall into. That is, if you're in your state of freedom, to justify what in actuality is a transgression of God's law. And it also can be quite serious. Turn to Jude chapter verses 3 and 4. Jude in verse 3. "Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints." Verse 4. "For there are certain men crept in unawares, who before of old ordained to this condemnation, ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness, and denying the only Lord and God, and our Lord Yeshua the Christ." Now there's the word lasciviousness is the word I want to center in on. Lasciviousness, as found in the King James Version, is not necessarily a poor translation of the Greek word, but I don't believe it's the best translation. I believe the New American Standard provides the best translation for the word. And the New American Standard translates it as licentiousness. What is licentiousness? Anybody want to hazard a... No, I know, you're getting gun-shy. Here's one definition for licentiousness. Free from moral restraint. Free from moral restraint. Now let that sink in, what that definition, just a little bit. What is that saying? What is moral restraint? Hopefully, if you're an Israelite with something written on your heart, that's Simple. Somebody, come on. What is moral? What's another term, another word for moral restraint? Law. So it's licentiousness is in essence then liberation from law. Or license to do what the law forbids. So in actuality, it's, think about this, it's licentiousness that the modern antinomian, anti-law preachers today are preaching. There, they are the fulfillment, in at least this day and age, of Jude verse 4. Those who have crept in unnoticed into our midst and have turned the grace of God into licentiousness. Webster's 1828 dictionary defines licentious as using license, indulging freedom to excess, unrestrained by law or morality, loose, dissolute, as a licentious man. Number two, exceeding the limits of law or propriety, wanton, unrestrained. It then defines licentiously with excess of liberty in contempt of law and morality. And then licentiousness as excessive indulgence of liberty, contempt of the just restraints of the law, morality and decorum. What a great definition or description, again, of our antinomian preachers today. That's what they're preaching. Plato said, law is the god of wise men, licentiousness is the god of fools. Proof is in the pudding, as the saying goes. You look at what antinomian licentious preachers have accomplished in this country, and you can see that indeed licentiousness is the preaching of fools. Once again, note the seriousness of the antinomian position. Jude 4 from New American Standard. For certain persons have crept in unnoticed, those who were long beforehand marked out for this condemnation, ungodly persons who turn the grace of our God into licentiousness and deny our only Lord, Master and Lord, Yeshua the Christ. Licentiousness or lawlessness is equated with denial of Yeshua. And isn't that what Yahweh himself likened it to? Turn to Matthew chapter 7. Again, I'll read it as I get here. Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 23. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven. Our churches today are full of people who are crying out, Lord, Lord, saying, Jesus is my Lord. But notice what he says. Many will say to me on that day, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father which is in heaven. Well, what's the will of the Father? 22, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name, and in thy name have cast out devils, and in thy name done many wonderful works? There's a lot of people claiming those things in today's churches. Every one of those things. And yet notice how he responds to some of those such people. Verse 23, and then I will profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. Now, iniquity is, again, in the King James Version, not a poor translation, but once again, I do not believe it's the best translation of that Greek word in that passage. New American Standard, again, translates this particular word as lawlessness. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. These words are translated from the Greek word anomian. From alpha, a negative participle, and nomos, law, specifically Yahweh. Literally, the word means anti-law, which is indeed what most of our preachers are today. Now, with this in mind, it can be seen that Yeshua in this passage also equated or declared that those who practice anti-law do not know him as Lord, or in practice, deny him as Lord. I mean, what makes him Lord of our life? What is a Lord? He's a master with laws he expects us to keep. And you can call him, you can claim him to be Lord all day long and for the rest of your life. But what determines whether he's Lord or not? Your obedience to him is Lord. And consequently, those who practice anti-law deny in practice him as Lord and will be sent away. So it should be quite evident that the antinomian, anti-law position is extremely serious. And the same holds true for someone who attempts to justify or license their transgression of the law. even if they believe the law is in existence, even if that's what they preach, that it's in existence and to be applied to our everyday lives. But if they fool themselves into justifying something that is not justified in the law, then their position is no different, at least in that particular area, than those who preach against the law of God entirely. That is, those who attempt to use some exemption to justify a non-exempt action. And people, it is easy to fall into that. And that's again why Paul warned us in Galatians chapter 5 to don't turn your freedom into a license for sin. And it's very easy to do it. God's given us the freedom. But I'll guarantee you take a hold of that freedom and take it too far, and you'll pay a consequence. What Yeshua also declared in Mark 2 in verse 27, where he said the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. This also is often used in attempting to give license to that which is unlawful. But it must be kept in mind that Yeshua was declaring in that statement that the Pharisees' application of those regulations was in error. Not that the regulations themselves were erroneous. It cannot be used as an exemption for the regulations. Just the application of the Pharisees. The Pharisees were making man subservient to the law rather than the laws to man. Their approach left no room whatsoever for exemptions. Whereas Yahweh's does allow for lawful or rightful exemptions. In other words, bottom line, our motives must always be scrutinized. You know, I find myself sometimes catching up with my motives. Sometimes I don't even realize what my motives are at the time. Consequently, it behooves all of us to scrutinize those motives. What is it? Why is it? Are we exempting ourselves or particular situations for our benefit? Pleasure or business, or for the sake of Yahweh and our fellow man. There's a great difference there. Our motives of our intent is extremely important also from the other side of the coin as well. John Calvin pointed out the Sabbath is violated even by good works so long as we regard them as our own. Good statement. One to think about. He also is accredited with pointing out that God's Sabbath are polluted when they are rendered to a series of observances. Actually, the prophet Isaiah declared that a long time before John Calvin did. Turn to Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29, verses 13 and 14. Wherefore the Lord said, "For as much as this people draw near me with their mouth and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precepts of men, or consist of traditions learned by rote. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work, and I wonder, for the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men will be hid. Yahweh, through Isaiah, was simply condemning those who performed the law mechanically, who allowed the regulations to become what was foremost in their minds. In other words, we must be careful in observing Sabbath that we don't become subservient to the regulations to the exclusion of Yahweh Himself. And that, again, is an easy to find a trap to find yourself in as well. You know, it's very comfortable. Legalism is very comfortable. It's basically a grave. It's like a rut. It's a grave with the two ends kicked out. But it's comfortable. Boy, you've got everything in writing, set down, and you're comfortable between those two walls. You know, nothing's going to touch you. But there's a lot of dangers in it as well. All of a sudden, you're again subservient to the regulations rather than to the regulator. We must be careful that what we do from love, not simply from acquiescence or conformity. Now, the inspiring story of Eric Little, who in the 1924 Olympics was one of the world's premier runners, is an inspiring story of what I'm talking about. How many saw this movie years back, or maybe even possibly recently on video, the movie Chariots of Fire. Only a few of you, I'm surprised. If you haven't seen that movie and you do watch videos, you've got a VCR, I encourage getting that movie. You talk about an inspiring story. The story of Eric Little is he was one of the foremost, again, world runners of the time in 1924, went for Scotland, I believe it was, to the Olympics. And then he found out that his trial runs for his event, for the final, was to be held in what he believed was his Sabbath. And he refused even to justify running, doing his pleasure on the Sabbath. He refused to justify it even for the sake of the Olympics. And then God turned that around, and they showed some of the headlines in this movie. Runner refuses to run for his God. It was three or four of them. So it was interesting. I watched this recently because of this message. And I did. It was interesting, Doug, because I never had seen this before, but I think there was a subliminal. That message, the movie is really about one runner who's a Christian and one runner who's a Jew. And they both end up winning one of the races. And Eric Little was God blessed and allowed. Another man came along who had already run a race, which is almost unheard of, and said, "Hey, I've run my race. I've got my medal. Let him run my race." And they allowed him to run a whole different race, a longer race he had never run before, and God bless him, he won that anyway. It was really interesting. There were these headlines that they were showing. Runner refuses to run on Sabbath for his God, and I forget some of the other ones, but it was a testimony to the whole world that this man was a servant of God. And yet it was interesting what Hollywood, I think, did, probably purposely in this situation, because Christianity was being exalted in telling this story, this true story. I think they put a subliminal in there to try to tie Christianity in with Nazism. Because they take these newspapers, this is all for extra, it was interesting, they take these newspapers and they do it, they'd show the headline and then they'd spin it out at you, just to remove it out of the picture. It was a, what would you call it, special effect. Well, in one of those headlines, as they spinned it, it became a swastika. And I think it probably was an intentional subliminal to try to put down Christianity nonetheless, even though it was elevated in this particular movie. But what an inspiring show. And again, I encourage, if you watch videos, if you do that, I encourage you to get it. If you've seen it before, see it again. Because it is an inspiring story of a man who was dedicated to his God and to his beliefs and his convictions and who would not compromise them, even in that particular situation. Had he done so, think about this, then his sport, or at least the Olympics, would have become his God, determining his morality. And maybe that's why God has made this such a commandment of consequence. Because in disobeying this commandment in many cases, you end up disobeying the first, of having other gods before Yahweh, or the second, creating idols before your God. At least a thought to think about. At the same time, even though he was dedicated, his conviction and his obedience was not simply out of duty, at least if the story shows it correctly, but rather instead from a heart filled with love for his God, willing to sacrifice whatever it was for the sake of his God. And shouldn't that be ours? I mean, what kind of God do you serve? Is he a God that's worth sacrificing whatever it is for his sake, to do his will, to accomplish his purpose, and to be a part of taking dominion back for him on this earth for our people? Well, that's the God I serve, and I hope it's the one you serve. What a tremendous example he provided for the rest of us. There certainly may be some hazy areas. There are some hazy areas when it comes to the Sabbath. But this one thing should be absolutely clear, that whatever the situation and whatever is done, it should be done unto the Lord, unto his glory and his honor and praise. I hope it will be so with you in the future if it hasn't been already. Thank you. I've appreciated being here. We're going to take a short break, and I think that's what we're planning, aren't you, Doug? And we'll come back, and you can fire questions at Doug and I'll listen. Thank you.